was Joe Torres speaking with Counterspin in 2011 about the book News for All the People. It's still available from Verso Books. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, FAIR.org. The show's engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race with independent journalists from the Pacific Northwest. From Grassroots News Northwest, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all of the things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
About
race. Welcome to another edition of Let's Talk About Race, where in the morning of 2021, we are faced with the neo-Confederate Republican Party, fresh off an acquittal of the impeachment and the promise of the Biden-Harris administration. This is our Hope and Hard Work show.
It is so nice to hear a president sound presidential. It is so nice to hear someone speak in complete sentences and begin to be a leader. I haven't seen that in 4 or 5 years. Or 4 years at least. I don't know what to say, how to interpret it. So we're back. Are we out of the twilight zone? Let me start with Althea. Althea, our theme is hope and hard work. The Biden administration. What is the hope of that administration and what hard work do you see in the next 30 days?
Yeah, I would second some of what from where you cite there being some hope, that there is leadership, that there is actually things that are changing and moving at a rapid pace, and not necessarily just errors, a comedy of errors that have now turned an entire political party into backsliding into fascism. In terms of things to be hopeful about, obviously, there's a multitude of issues that have grown much more severe over the past 4 years of the Trump presidency that we now have a meaningful chance to address with Democrats controlling the Senate, the House, and the presidency. So, obviously, addressing climate change, immigration reform, potentially legalizing marijuana, reforming our prison system, and not the least of which is more meaningful coronavirus relief and an actual plan to distribute vaccines. All of that, I think there is real hope in making change. And I think that there is this sense and a sense that the Trump administration created that these issues are incredibly pressing and that it's not just climate change that has a clock ticking. There is a moment when it becomes too late to tackle these things. But to do it, it will take a ton of concentrated effort to undo what has happened in the past 4 years, because the conflict between our political parties is not an ideological divide, but one that has a commitment to democracy and one that I mentioned is backsliding into fascism, because the GOP is so devoted to Trump and how, you know, central QAnon conspiracy theories have become.
But what we saw in that Senate today was a cowardly group of Republicans who apparently have no options because they were afraid to defend their job, respect the institution in which they served. Imagine that it would be vandalized in so many bad ways that I won't even go into here. And that they would not respect their institute, that the president of the Senate, Mike Pence, hang Mike Pence, was the chant, and they just dismissed that. Why? Because maybe they can't get another job. What is so important about any one of us? What is so important about the political survival of any one of us that is more important than our Constitution that we take an oath to protect and defend?
One thing that I'm concerned about, especially in thinking about this hard work, is to what level is there a commitment to quote-unquote unity, and what unity can be had in this moment when it's a very nebulous idea, you know? What does it mean to be? Does it mean to be united in the idea that a democratic process should work? that didn't even come to fruition. And the other thing that I've noted in terms of hard work is that already Republican state legislatures are introducing bills to limit the remarkable expansions to voting accessibility that were achieved in 2020. There's a Chicago Tribune article that cites more than 100 bills in 28 states that are meant to restrict voting access. And they're doing it under the guise of, you know, we need to firm up the public trust in our elections. But really what it means in, you know, Texas, Arizona, Georgia, Pennsylvania, is putting criminal offenses on voter fraud. Voter fraud, we know, doesn't happen very often. Making it hard, making more stringent voter ID laws, creating more burdens on people to make sure that they're eligible to vote, and making it easier to kick people off the rolls. There's a lot of things that, you know, Republicans lost this time because of this expansion of voting rights, and then now they're trying to shore up that for the future. So I think that's another site where there's a lot of hard work to be had.
We know that it is true that voters have been purged from the rolls, thousands of whom should never have been removed. We know that there are communities that experience multi-hour lines when communities that are better situated and whiter have a faster attempt and a faster capacity. We know that the issues of voter suppression played out in plain sight when we saw state after state try to force people to go to the polls in unsafe conditions rather than allowing them to use the safety of voting by mail. Then you have the lies that were told by Donald Trump and by his adherents. We had more than 60 lawsuits where evidence could not be produced. We saw Donald Trump himself at the outset of his administration convene a voting fraud task force and dismantle it because they could not find proof. There has been absolutely no proof of widespread voter fraud. It did not happen. And this year, Republican leaders acknowledged that that was true. And so the moment we create this false equivalence between voter suppression, which has been baked into our nation since its inception, and voter fraud, which largely in the 20th century and 21st centuries has been a figment of imagination, then we cannot give them equal time and equal measure. We have to dismiss and push back against voter fraud so we can focus on ensuring that every eligible citizen in the United States of America has the same ease of voting, no matter who they are, where they live, or the color of their skin.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race, our hope and hard work show. The hope of the Biden-Harris administration and the hard work they have to do to address a raging pandemic, economic stagnation, and the reordering of the delivery of public education, all trying to work with the neo-Confederate Republican Party. Hope and hard work on this edition of Let's Talk About Race.
Let's move on to Cecil, our talk show host. Cecil, hope and hard work. Address both topics.
I think it's incredible to be able to wake up without going to my phone and seeing what did the president tweet while I was asleep. And I think that boring can be exciting. And so my hope is that the president will be boring, that his administration will just do the hard work, and that will be fine with me. It's been exciting to see how the president and the vice president have unrolled their administration. I think to the surprise of many, with the number of executive orders, which have been incredible number in the last 20 days he's been in office.
There's a lot of talk, with good reason, about the number of executive orders that I have signed. I'm not making new law. I'm eliminating bad policy. What I'm doing is taking on the issues that 99% of them, that the president, the last president of the United States, issued executive orders I thought were very counterproductive to our security, counterproductive to who we are as a country, particularly in the area of immigration. This is about how America is safer, stronger, more prosperous when we have a fair, orderly, and humane legal immigration system. And with the first action today, we're going to work to undo the moral and national shame of the previous administration that literally, not figuratively, ripped children from the arms of their families, their mothers and fathers at the border, and with no plan, none whatsoever, to reunify the children who are still in custody and their parents. The second action addresses the root causes of our migration to our southern border. And the third action, the third order I'm going to be signing, orders a full review of the previous administration's harmful and counterproductive immigration policies, basically across the board.
How progressive they are. I think that was a surprise. And that I think that is the result of a lot of hard work by progressives in various states to become a part of that team. And while maybe some of the top leadership in the administrations might be look boring and as such may not excite many people, I think that those who are working in various departments and cabinet offices are progressives. And so the challenge is to see that this progressive push continue, and we must realize that the hard work is making sure that legislation is enacted. You know, the problem with executive orders is that they're limited, and as we've seen with this new administration, you can just undo the executive order of a previous administration. So if the next administration comes with a different political philosophy, they can just as easily undo the executive orders of the president. So we have to make sure that the work in Congress, both House and Senate, is done, and the hard work of passing laws.
It's what the core values of this nation call us to do. And I believe the vast majority of Americans, Democrats, Republicans, and independents, share these values and want us to act as well. We have never fully lived up to the founding principles of this nation, to state the obvious, that all people are created equal and have a right to be treated equally throughout their lives. And it's time to act now, not only because it's the right thing to do, but because if we do, we'll all be better off for it. For too long, we've allowed a narrow, cramped view of the promise of this nation to fester. You know, we've bought the view that America is a zero-sum game in many cases. If you succeed, I fail. If you get ahead, I fall behind. If you get the job, I lose mine. Maybe worst of all, if I hold you down, I lift myself up. We've lost sight of what President Kennedy told us when he said, a rising tide lifts all boats. And when we lift each other up, we're all lifted up. You know, and the corollary is true as well. When any one of us is held down, we're all held back. More and more economic studies in recent years have proven this. But I don't think you need economic studies to see the truth. Just imagine if instead of consigning millions of American children to under-resourced schools, we gave each and every 3-4-year-old child a chance to learn, to go to school, not daycare, school, and grow, and thrive in school and throughout. When they've done that, the places have been done, it shows they have an exponentially greater chance of going all the way through 12 years of school and doing it well. But you know, does anyone in this whole nation think we're not all better off if that were to happen? Just imagine if instead of denying millions of Americans the ability to own a home and build generational wealth, we made it possible for them to buy a home, their first home, and began to build equity to provide for their families and send their children off to school. Does anyone doubt that the whole nation would be better off? Just imagine, instead of denying millions of young entrepreneurs the ability to access capital, we made it possible to take their dream to market, create jobs, reinvest in their own communities. Does anyone doubt this whole nation wouldn't be better off? Just imagine if more incredibly creative and innovative, how much more creative and innovative we'd be if this nation held the historic Black colleges and universities to the same opportunities and minority-serving institutions that had the same funding and resources of public universities to compete for jobs and industries of the future. You know, just ask the first HBCU graduate elected as vice president if that's not true. But to do this, I believe this nation and this government need to change their whole approach to the issue of racial equity. Yes, we need criminal justice reform, but that isn't nearly enough. We need to open the promise of America to every American. And that means we need to make the issue of racial equity not just an issue for any one department of government. It has to be the business of the whole of government. That's why I issued, in one of the first days, my whole government executive order that will, for the first time, advance equity for all throughout our federal policies and institutions. It focuses on the full range of communities who have been long underserved and overlooked. People of color, Americans with disabilities, LGBTQ Americans, religious minorities, rural, urban, suburban communities facing persistent poverty. And I've asked Ambassador Susan Rice to lead the administration's charge through the White House and Domestic Policy Council, because I know she'll see it through. Every White House component and every agency will be involved in this work, because advancing equity has to be everyone's job. Today, I'll be shortly signing an additional package of executive actions to continue this vital work. Housing, for example. Housing is a right in America, and home ownership is an essential tool to wealth creation and to be passed down to generations. Today, I'm directing the Department of Housing and Urban Affairs and Urban Development to redress the historical racism in federal housing policies. Today, I'm directing the federal agency to reinvigorate the consultation process with Indian tribes. Respect for tribal sovereignty will be a cornerstone of our engaging with Native American communities. This builds on the work we did last week to expand tribes' access to the Strategic National Stockpile for the first time, to ensure they receive help from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, to fight this pandemic. Today, I'm directing federal agencies to combat resurgence of xenophobia, particularly against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, that we've seen skyrocket during this pandemic. This is unacceptable, and it's un-American. I've asked the Department of Justice to strengthen its partnership with the Asian American and Pacific Islander community to prevent those hate crimes. I've also asked the Department of Health and Human Services to put out best practices for combating xenophobia in our national response to COVID. Look, in the weeks ahead, I'll be reaffirming the federal government's commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion and accessibility, building on the work we started in the Obama-Biden administration. That's why I'm rescinding the previous administration's harmful ban on diversity and sensitivity training and abolish the offensive counterfactual 1776 Commission. Unity and healing must begin with understanding and truth, not ignorance and lies. Today, I'm also issuing an executive order that will ultimately end the Justice Department's use of private prisons, an industry that houses pretrial detainees and federal prisoners. The executive order directs the Attorney General to decline to renew contracts with privately operated criminal facilities, a step we started to take at the end of the Obama administration and was reversed under the previous administration. This is the first step to stop corporations from profiting off of incarceration that is less humane and less safe, as the studies show. And it is just the beginning of my administration's plan to address systemic problems in our criminal justice system. Here's another thing we need to do. We need to restore and expand the Voting Rights Act, named after our dear friend John Lewis, and continue to fight back against laws that many states are engaged in to suppress the right to vote while expanding access to the ballot box for all eligible voters. Because here's the deal, and I'll close with this. I ran for president because I believe we're in a battle for the soul of this nation. And the simple truth is, our soul will be troubled as long as systemic racism is allowed to persist. We can't eliminate it. It's not going to be overnight. We can't eliminate everything, but it's corrosive, it's destructive, and it's costly. It cost every American, not just who felt the sting of racial injustice. We aren't just less of a, we are not just a nation of morally deprived because of systemic racism. We're also less prosperous. We're less successful. We're less secure. So we must change, and I know it's going to take time, but I know we can do it. And I firmly believe the nation is ready to change, but government has to change as well. We need to make equity and justice part of what we do every day, today, tomorrow, and every day. And I'm going to sign these executive actions to continue the work to make real the promise of America for every American. Again, I'm not promising we can end it tomorrow, but I promise you we're going to continue to make progress to eliminate systemic racism, and every branch of the White House and the federal government is going to be part of that effort. Thank you.
Thank you, Cecil. Let's move on to Professor Johnson. Professor Johnson, hope and hard work. Want to chime in on this, please?
Sure. One thing that gives me hope, I'll start with that, is the administration that Biden is selecting. And I just think we all have PTSD, which is, or PDSD, post-Donald Trump disorder. And it is so refreshing, actually, to see work getting done and to see qualified people being placed in roles. I was very pleased to see Merrick Garland, that he was going to be the new Attorney General. Thought that was a great selection. Antony Blinken, who is going to be the Secretary of State, or is the Secretary of State. Janet Yellen. I mean, these are very strong people, and I'm confident in Biden's choices that he's going to put real people in there that can do the work. So I'm hopeful about, that's one thing I'm hopeful about. And the other thing I'm hopeful for is that there seems to be finally, after all that has happened, a little bit of a fracture in the Republican Party. The majority of them are still supporting Trump, but when you have someone come out like Cheney, who to say and vote that, you know, Trump, or voice her opinion that Trump should be impeached, that is definitely one of the fractures that we're seeing in the party. And the other one, I think, has to do with how far can they go aligned with QAnon. I guess I echo my other journalists that have spoken in respect to the number of executive orders that Biden has done, the swiftness, how comprehensive they are, how well thought out they are. And in many cases, he's setting them up, not just as this is as a starting point, looking to have review committees as well as individuals specifically assigned to take responsibility for and have action. So I actually think that these changes, these executive orders, are going to have outcomes.
President Biden has hit the ground running, issuing many executive orders in his first days in office.
First one is the economic relief related to COVID-19 pandemic.
I'll be signing an executive order in just a moment, tightening the existing Buy American policies and go further.
The second one is protecting the federal workforce.
Transgender personnel, if qualified in every other way, can serve their government in the United States military.
Many of these orders have essentially undone executive orders issued by the previous president.
Many of the things that Joe Biden signed today are pure reversals of executive actions that Donald Trump took. So think about it as the pendulum swinging, the flip of a switch.
In his first 7 days in office, President Biden issued 19 executive orders. By comparison, in his first week in office, President Trump issued 4, President Obama issued 5, and President George W. Bush issued none in his first week.
These orders do carry the force of law, but they're not actually laws.
Using executive orders has become a useful tool for making immediate progress in the face of congressional gridlock.
10 months ago in Paris, I said before the world that we needed a strong global agreement to reduce carbon pollution and to set the world on a low carbon course. The result was the Paris Agreement.
But the relative ease of issuing executive orders means they are just as quickly reversed.
I withdrew the United States from the terrible one-sided Paris Climate Accord. It was a total disaster for our country.
An executive order may only last as long as the president's term.
And I believe he's shown us that he has learned something as the vice president with Barack Obama, and that is that when Republicans signal bipartisanship, it doesn't happen. All these discussions about the stimulus bill, we just have to go back and take a look at what happened to Obama with the American Recovery and Investment Act. And how much pushback he got from the Republican Party. In fact, only 3 senators signed that. And then what happened? We had a very slow recovery. Economists attributed to not doing enough to stimulate the economy. And then they spent several years blaming Obama for a slow recovery. So I think we really have to appreciate that Biden, I don't think, is going to get caught in that trap again.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
Faith reporter Nia Gray, hope and hard work.
So I would like to start out by saying that I agree with my esteemed colleagues on both of those points, you know, that how Biden is using the executive orders to erase Trump's white supremacist legacy. It's too bad he can't reverse the tax refund that all of the corporations got. But, you know, that's what happened with Trump, is that because he was governing with a pen with just executive orders, there wasn't any real legislation happening in this country for the last 4 years. So it was easy to erase that. And I also agree that the real change we'll see is having qualified, appointed people to these positions and not just a top donor or a friend or someone that is completely unqualified. Some of the executive orders that I was, you know, running around my house screaming hallelujah about was, you know, us getting back into the Paris Climate Initiative. I thought that was excellent. And then the no-brainers of repealing the Trump-era proclamations that the Muslim ban, what we consider the Muslim ban for travel from United States or to the United States from prominently Muslim African countries with brown people coming here. And, you know, I also like that in the executive order that he made a point that that hurt a lot of people. And so what are we going to do to fix some of the issues that came out of that Muslim ban? So that's a no-brainer. But then I think he took it a step further. He canceled the 1776 commission, Trump's executive order to rewrite history, say that slavery wasn't an American issue, but a global issue. So, I mean, every day when I was watching the news, I felt better. I think that what Biden should do and can do is now we've got someone that can help us with some of these federal initiatives. What are we going to do at the state level? And I would really like to see Biden's administration reach out and work with governors, because that's where we're going to see immediate change with the COVID relief, with the vaccines, mask initiatives or mask laws and things like that. I think what happened with Trump is he had his red states and his blue states, and even on a state level, that they're completely in disarray and not unified. So I'd like to see him reach out with that. And then lastly, the gift that keeps giving, not just for Biden, but for all of us, is the Trumpless Twitter. So we don't have these deranged tweets every hour all throughout the night that people can actually focus on, you know, the good things that the Biden administration's doing.
The executive order, or orders, plural, that speaks to me are the number of orders he has given to try to control this pandemic. It is amazing the number of orders from day one, starting January 20th. Interestingly, the previous president took it so lightly, and we're talking about the lives of hundreds of thousands of Americans. It's just so nice to see him take science into consideration. We have Dr. Fauci.
This executive order I'm signing is strengthening the supply chain.
Armed only with a bank of presidential pens, the commander-in-chief took command.
400,000 Americans have died. That's more than have died in all of World War II.
With each order, he conscripted Americans to take up arms against an enemy overrunning them.
This is a wartime undertaking.
A safe and effective vaccine at breakneck speed.
Donald Trump's Operation Warp Speed turns out to have been a sluggish misnomer. Military powers will now be invoked to accelerate it by ordering more manufacturing of syringes and supplies. Federally run emergency vaccination centers are on their way. All incoming passengers must be tested before travel and quarantine on arrival. Masks will be made compulsory for interstate travel to keep a Biden goal on track.
This is the plan. This is the plan.
100 million shots in arms in the next 99 days.
Our national strategy is comprehensive. It's based on science, not politics. It's based on truth, not denial.
Scientific advice the new administration's relying on comes from the same expert the previous one had, until Donald Trump placed him on the outer. So how does Anthony Fauci feel now?
There were things that were said that really was an uncomfortable because they were not based on scientific fact. Let the science speak. It is somewhat of a liberating feeling.
America's abysmal pandemic performance is the result of collective failure. Much, but not all of the blame can be sheeted home to Washington. Even so, the Biden administration's positioning itself to reap the credit for any turnaround when it comes, and to ensure Donald Trump bears full responsibility for the disastrous last year.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
These executive orders around the coronavirus really speak to me. It lets me know we're going to address this pandemic and try to control it. I don't know if you can control a pandemic, but to ensure that the hundreds of thousands of Americans who have died, that we have no more of it. And I love how President Biden mourns the deaths of these Americans from coronavirus. I don't recall Trump ever saying anything about the Americans who died from coronavirus. Do you, Cecil? I'm gonna start with you.
I think the president is leading by not only executive orders, but by his actions, by heightening the importance of having a national rollout and national plan to address the coronavirus, making sure that equity is a part of the nation's rollout of the vaccine, and how we address it. In addition, I think for me, the thing that has been important for me to hear is the president reversing many of the policies regarding immigration that he has led by example. What we have noticed, however, is that in many of the departments of ICE, who has been filled with members who are loyal to the former president's worldview, that we do see immigrants who are being thrown out of the country. And so that reveals that even though you have an order from the top, that the president needs to, and I think we've seen some evidence of this, to clean out the bureaucracy, which has been in many departments filled with those who are loyal to the former President Trump ideology and regime and ways of acting. So that, great that he is addressing immigration, but it's more than just executive orders, that his top appointees must see that the people in those departments are following through on the president's desires and actions.
So in summary, what you mean is that deportation, forced deportation, is continuing to happen even with this new president, correct?
Yes, exactly. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, Cecil. We're going to move on to Althea. Althea, which of these executive orders speak to you? And there's a plethora of them.
Yeah, there's a lot of things to be excited about here, as we've remarked upon. I think the one that got to me the most first off, because it was like first day, was undoing the quote unquote Muslim ban, because that was one of the first real examples in the Trump administration of how bad he could be. There was all this rhetoric in 2016 of, you know, people, you know, rightly mentioning that Trumpism is close to fascism. There was these sort of, you know, this talk of like, oh no, the people that elected Trump, no, they're good people and they did what they thought they had to do. You know, how bad could it really be? He's a Republican president. He's sure, he likes Twitter, but it'll be fine. And I think that the Muslim travel ban was one of the primary wounds, one of the first things that we really saw that exemplified racism, xenophobia, this bigoted attitude that would pervade the Trump administration. And so seeing that just with a snap changed, not that, as Nia mentioned, not that that, you know, soothes the wounds of what 4 years of that policy had created, but that it is simply enough that we're not doing that anymore. I would also point out the canceling of the Keystone XL pipeline, that has been something that has been stuck in litigation and has been a struggle for indigenous activists for years, and it's canceled.
And for more reaction now, we're joined by Ariel Duranger. She's the executive director of Indigenous Climate Action and a member of Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation. Those lands are just upstream from some of Alberta's biggest energy projects. Ariel, I assume it's safe to say that you are welcoming this announcement from Biden.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a step in the right direction. We have, as the country of Canada, we've signed on to the Paris Agreement. We've made commitments to climate change. We've made promises to Indigenous communities to respect Indigenous rights and uphold our say over our lands and territories. And yet we're still seeing these types of projects not just pushed onto our own communities, but now we're trying to force them into other nations.
So can you explain what kinds of impacts the oil and gas industry has had on your community over the past decades?
You know, the oil sands development is one of the largest infrastructures on planet Earth. So it's a huge undertaking that requires a massive amount of resources, not just the land in which these projects exist on, but it involves the extraction of massive amounts of water. It involves the importing of natural gas in order to process these plants and pull the oil away from the soil and create the oil. What that results in is not just this physical imprint of the projects themselves, but a destabilization of the ecosystems beyond the project limit boundaries. And this has huge implications on the communities in and around the extraction zone, from the water table destabilization, the water contamination, the air quality, and the quality of life, and our ability to continue practicing treaty and Aboriginal rights to hunting, fishing, and trapping, and accessing our traditional territories in a safe way. Overall, the quality of health for many of the communities has severely diminished since these projects have taken off in the 90s.
We're in a tiff with Canada about it, but it's the right thing to do.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race, our hope and hard work show. The hope of the Biden-Harris administration and the hard work they have to do to address a raging pandemic, economic stagnation, and the reordering of the delivery of public education, all trying to work with the neo-Confederate Republican Party. Hope and hard work on this edition of Let's Talk About Race.
We're going to move on with Professor Johnson and end it with our faith reporter, Nia Gray. Professor Johnson, which executive order speaks to you?
The executive order that speaks to me is laying the foundation for a $15 an hour minimum wage.
Our recovery plan also calls for an increase in the minimum wage at least $15 an hour. No one in America should work 40 hours a week making below the poverty line. $15 gets people above the poverty line. We have so many millions of people working 40 hours a week, working, and some with two jobs, and they're still below the poverty line.
And there are many companies that have already done that. So there's a lot of arguments out there that this is going to cause a problem. But Amazon, Target, Wells Fargo, Walt Disney, they all have or are moving to a $15 an hour wage. That one is important because I think our eye needs to be on recovery. And I like, there were many of his executive orders that directly affect the economy. And I was very pleased to see how comprehensive it was. He had one executive order that focused on strengthening buying American. I think that will stimulate the economy. The wage, continuing the moratorium on evictions and foreclosures. And there was an executive order to strengthen food assistance. All of these things are very important now. And there are many other executive orders that also will support people during this difficult time in our economy.
Our plan includes access to affordable child care. That's going to enable parents, particularly women, to get back to work. Millions who are not working now because they don't have that care. All told, the American Rescue Plan would lift 12 million Americans out of poverty and cut child poverty in half. That's 5 million children lifted out of poverty. Our plan would reduce poverty in the Black community by one-third and reduce poverty in the Hispanic community by almost 40%.
Thank you, Professor Johnson. Now, Nia Gray, President Biden said he's not making laws. He's trying to change bad policy. Which executive order speaks to you?
The executive order that speaks to me is the executive order regarding ethics, to restore ethics in the executive branch and all over in different branches and offices of the government. For me, the way that Trump used the Department of Justice as his own personal legal team was really upsetting. And I think to move forward, what I love about this executive order is that it aims, this is what it says in the order, is to, quote, restore and maintain public trust in government and ensure that we're a government of the people, so that folks that are going to work and working for us, that they act in the interest of the American people and not for personal gain. So doing a little bit of research, I found that this is similar to a ban that they had in the Obama administration. So it bans folks from accepting gifts from lobbyists, which is interesting because as a salesperson, there are corporations that have bans or limits on the gifts that I can purchase. So I thought that was pretty interesting that, you know, a senator can fly across the country for free and it can be on a lobbyist dime and it's not a big deal. So they can't accept gifts from lobbyists. There's a prohibition on appointees and lobbyists entering the administration, and then also restricts foreign agents from entering the administration as well.
All right. Thank you, Crew. We're going to address what we didn't talk about. Let's start with Cecil. Cecil, what didn't we talk about on this edition of Let's Talk About Race?
What we did not talk about in any depth is the continued problem of white supremacy. What we've seen is how it is entrenched in the Republican Party. And I like to remind ourselves that the Republican Party was Trump before Trump was Trump. Remember the Tea Party. So this is something that is not going away. And the fact that some Republicans are resistant very lightly does not mean that white supremacy in the Republican Party will go away, and that we need to continue to be vigilant about the rise of white supremacy and how it may go further underground.
There were parts of the GOP that we have to look at and be honest about what it was. We didn't as a broad party look at the people in parts of the base in the South and parts of the Midwest who were not motivated by free markets or limited government or individual liberty. They were motivated by racial animus. And there is a part of it that's out there. And we have to look at it honestly. And I look back and I saw, you know, Ronald Reagan years ago saying there's no place in this Republican Party for anti-Semitism or the Klan or racial hatred. And on and on and on. But we still had some of those people in the base and we never purged them. And we should have purged them. We never did it. Got to own it. Now, Donald Trump has played footsie with these people from the beginning. Remember, in the 2016 campaign, it took Donald Trump 2.5 weeks to denounce David Duke. How do you denounce David Duke? You denounce David Duke instantaneously. You don't wait 2 weeks.
That's right. They say the Republican Party is now the neo-Confederate Party. And moving on, what we didn't talk about, let's start with Althea and then Professor Johnson. Althea, what didn't we talk about on this edition of Let's Talk About Race?
Well, there are still plenty of executive orders that we did not quite get to discuss, and there's one of the equity-related ones that I wanted to draw attention to that acknowledges the rise in discrimination against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders in the past year, especially related to the COVID pandemic.
There is a so-called other virus that is spreading across America amid the coronavirus pandemic. Ethnic Media Services Zoom panelists describe this as a contagion of hate targeting members of the Asian American community. The Stop AAPI Hate organization has recorded more than 2,700 incidents of hate-motivated crime and discrimination against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders since the onset of the pandemic.
Slightly over 70% involve verbal harassment. 9% of them involve physical assault, pushing, shoving, throwing a backpack, throwing cans or bottles. So while they are concerning, again, they wouldn't be cases that are brought before a judge and a jury. 10% involve civil rights violations.
The Anti-Defamation League, or ADL, has also reported that there was a dramatic spike in anti-Asian hostility and conspiracy theories on Twitter immediately after President Donald Trump's tweet about his coronavirus positive diagnosis on October 1st. The ADL said, "The spread of xenophobic, racist, or anti-Semitic conspiracy theories create a dangerous political environment that could potentially result in harassment, discrimination, and even violence against targeted groups. For months now, President Trump has repeatedly blamed China for the spread of COVID-19 that has devastated America with more than 7.9 million infections and over 217,000 deaths. Trump even went as far as calling the coronavirus the China plague.
They just put out a report this morning tracking online hate and showing spikes in online hate directed at Asian Americans.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Are you a KBOO member? Tell us why you support KBOO.